Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Freedom of Species would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land on which we broadcast today. We pay our respect to the elders of all of the lands on which we meet across Australia.
Hello and welcome to Freedom of Species, the show that brings animal advocacy to the airwaves of 3CR Community Radio. You just heard Sal with Out of the Pan, who had guest Sarah Fegan from Living Positive Victoria Bi++, a HIV positive and bi group, as part of Celebrate Bisexuality Month. So happy Celebrate Bisexuality Month, everyone.
Woo!
Sally just finished with the song Fiesta by Tommy Emmanuel. So yeah, check out of the Pan with Sally every Sunday, 12 to 1, for pansexual, trans and gender diverse, polyamorous and queer issues, news and events. So I'm Lottie, your host today of Freedom of Species, and I'm joined by Hayden.
Hello.
So today we're going to be discussing systemic and individual actions to create social change, including for animal justice and the environment. So yeah, thanks for joining me today, Hayden, as we have this conversation. So I'll kind of jump in with giving a bit of background. So I read this book recently called Somebody Should Do Something, How Anyone Can Help Create Social Change by Michael Brownstein, Alex Madvar and Daniel Kelly. The blurb of this book is, changing the world is difficult. One reason is that the most important problems, like climate change, racism and poverty, are structural. They emerge from our collective practices, laws, economies, history, culture, norms and built environments. The dilemma is that there's no way to make structural change without individual people making different, more structure-facing decisions. In Somebody Should Do Something, Michael Brownstein, Alex Madvar, and Daniel Kelly show us how we can connect our personal choices to structural change and why individual choices matter, though not in the way people usually think. So Hayden, just starting off, do you kind of have thoughts or experience in your life of this kind of interface or this kind of dichotomy of individual and systemic change and how that kind of affects people's behaviours?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so, in the sense that surrounding veganism, I think definitely I've encountered people, or at least when it comes to not even necessarily going vegan, but reducing like their intake of like animal products, for instance, have this idea that as an individual, like, it doesn't make a difference, and that like, oh, like, it's such a negligible amount, them being as an individual doing this, so like they shouldn't like have to do it, or it doesn't matter whether they do it. I think, you know, you get people with the same kind of attitude when it comes to like climate change as well, I think, where they have this idea that there's like, as an individual, they don't necessarily have a onus to do anything because it should only be a social level change. And I think, like, we're probably going to talk today about how the two interact, and it is something that I find a bit annoying, because obviously, like, social level change comes from a collective of individuals kind of like advocating or making a change. So like, while it can kind of come from top down from government, there needs to be some kind of like impetus from the people who are governed leading into that. So it very much frustrates me when individuals act as though they're completely like have no culpability for their individual actions because they're just a drop in a bucket.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I've had very similar experiences. And yeah, we're definitely going to go into that. So I guess, yeah, kind of going back to that blurb, like, some of the structures that we face are things that seem like quite, difficult, or they feel more external to change, like laws and economies. But part of that is also what they also said in the blurb is like norms and culture. And I don't think laws and economies are ever going to change if the cultures and norms don't kind of change with them. And we do have an influence in our culture and our norms. We can't change the world. We can't change the whole world just as an individual, but we all have a role to play in our spheres.
And I think there's definitely a feedback both ways between like laws and regulations, between norms and culture.
Yeah,
I think, laws influence norms and culture, and norms and culture influence laws. So I think.
For sure. Yeah, and that's what they go into in this book. They kind of mostly focus on the issues of climate change and racism, which are definitely very huge, maybe kind of seemingly insurmountable issues in some ways. So I think it's very important to focus on those. In this show, we're going to be focusing on animal justice and veganism, because we're on Freedom of Species. But, you know, this definitely interfaces very much so with climate change, and even, you know, to some extent, racism and environmental racism, food deserts. There are definitely issues that relate to racism that also interface with animal justice and plant-based food systems. That's going to be our focus today.
So if we have any oppression, you can't advocate against particular oppression, because if we have any oppression, then we have all oppression. So
yeah.
I think it's always intersectional. Thinking of it as a single issue is never very helpful.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's not what they're doing in the book. They just kind of use those as case studies. So they kind of start off the book framing it as like, we've kind of got this either or thinking when it comes to individual and systemic change. And when it comes to maybe sometimes individual change is a bit like this mentality of like, oh, well, all little things add up, and as long as I'm doing my part, that's kind of enough, and that's all there is to it. They acknowledge, and I completely agree, that this like overly individualistic thinking ignores the roles of systems. And maybe historically there's been too much of that, and so now we're a little bit overly cautious of the role that individuals have to play. We do have reason to be skeptical of too much of an emphasis on individualistic activism, I guess. And an example that they point out, and that, yeah, I think is very relevant, is that the concept of a carbon footprint, an individual's carbon footprint, was actually popularized by BP, British Petroleum, to divert attention from the fossil fuel industry. But then on the other hand, if we kind of, what they argue is that we have kind of overcorrected from this individualistic thinking, where, you know, this idea that there's too much responsibility is foisted on individuals, to what, and, you know, I'm quoting here, these responses to rampant individualism just substitute one monolithic, oversimplified either-or view for another. So it is, not correct to just completely ignore the role of individuals and to only focus on systems. And that kind of either, if you have that either-or thinking and you focus on one or the other, in both cases, you're kind of screwing yourself over and not allowing, you're kind of hitting a wall either way. There's another quote: personal choices feel insignificant or like succumbing to corporate propaganda, while trying to change the system can feel overwhelming and a gargantuan undertaking with long odds of success. And I think I've kind of noticed this too, that maybe recently there's been this more rhetoric of like, oh, well, capitalism sucks. The world sucks. The world's, you know, falling apart. We're on fire. But, you know, it's the industries, it's the systems. I don't really need to do anything about that. Have you kind of experienced that?
Well, I feel like it's the classic, I think it's a response to veganism sometimes. I think it's a response sometimes when you're advocating for someone to make a more ethical choice, where they just say no ethical consumption under capitalism, and use that to justify what they're doing, and kind of act as if that means that all things are equal under capitalism. And so kind of being like, well, until the system changes, it doesn't matter what I do.
Yeah.
And ignoring the impact that your actions do have.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. What they talk about in the book, an important part of why individual actions and individual advocacy does matter is that it's important to change hearts and minds, or, you know, to change the culture and the norms, like I said before.
Or as the poet said, from little things, big things grow.
Yep, and that's actually going to be one of our songs on the show today.
There we go.
Coming to the example of racism that they use in the book, they ask, what could it mean to change racist policies directly without persuading anyone to do anything differently? So yes, of course, it's important that we don't just focus on racist microaggressions. We also acknowledge that there are structural racist structures out there that prevent people from, you know, getting housing, you know, gentrification, career advancement, things like that. But how could those structures possibly change if every single person in their, you know, in their heart of hearts remains just as racist as they are today? We do need to make people less racist for that to kind of, you know, shift the dial.
Feel like, you know, within a system where you've got formal structures to prevent racism, you can still have individuals making like racist choices. Like if you've got a boss who refuses to promote someone who's not of the same race as them, they can justify that in any number of ways, and there's no legal recourse to that. So
yeah.
you can still have those systemic effects where you have like a racial hierarchy within the system, even if formally there's no mechanism to enforce that.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. Yeah, so what they say in the book is that what happens in hearts and minds surely matters, but what causes those changes in hearts and minds is often changes to systems and structures. So, you know, if we have these new anti-discrimination laws and things like that come about, that might help shift people to be less racist. But then what causes changes to those systems and structures is often people with conviction in their hearts and new ideas in their minds to make those changes happen. So bringing it back to veganism and animal justice, I think that thinking about it in this way, being vegan but not caring what other people do, or this idea maybe from non-vegans that vegans, it's fine for them to eat vegan, but they shouldn't care about what, you know, they shouldn't care about if other people are vegan. They shouldn't try and talk about it. They shouldn't talk about it and the benefits of veganism and spread that, you know, this idea that animals matter. I don't think that is individualistic kind of thinking that is not strategic, I don't think, and probably isn't going to make much of a difference in the world. But what they argue in the book is that if we take these individual actions and we think of that as advocating for these behaviors that we would like other people in our lives to also do, that is a way to create cultural norms changing for the better.
Yeah, I don't know if the book talks about this with regards to racism, but it's really interesting the history of like slavery with the British Empire and the abolition of slavery in the British Empire, because kind of the attitude of like slavery is okay to slavery was bad happened within one generation and started essentially with like maybe like less than 10 individuals who decided to like realize this was really bad, started advocating against it, and then ended up influencing norms and culture within their lifetimes, which led to structural changes, which led to the abolition of slavery. And that was just like within one generation, just from individuals deciding it's bad and then taking action to try and influence those around them, which led to structural change.
Yeah.
And it's like a really interesting like case study, I think, like for vegans generally, in terms of like how individual moral conviction can help change like cultural norms and structural norms. But I think it's a good example of like what you're talking about, the influence and interaction between like structural and individual actions. Because obviously, like if the British state hadn't made it illegal to trade slaves, then some people still would have done it. But if those individuals hadn't moved to like influence the culture and make people see that this is a bad thing, the state never would have stepped in to take action.
Yeah, definitely. Exactly. Yeah. So what we can think of instead is, rather than this dichotomy of either individual or systemic change, they it's both. It's both and. But more than that, it's not a linear sequence from one to the other. It's this constant feedback between people and systems that, you know, eventually can create social change. And it's really important that you see yourself as part of the system, not somehow separate from it and having nothing to do with these systemic changes that need to happen. Yeah. And should we go to our first song? Did you have any thoughts on that? Or
No, let's go to a song. Yeah.
All right, so we'll go to our first song. This is Man in the Mirror by Michael Jackson. This one is maybe a bit of a overly focus on individual change, but like we've been talking about, it's definitely important not to completely forget about individual change, so I think it's relevant here. This is Freedom of Species.
Freedom of Species thanks Animal Free Science Advocacy for their financial support of this program. Animal Free Science Advocacy works to create a future where no animals are harmed in the name of science, and scientific progress is advanced through animal-free research methods. Become a member today by visiting animalfreesci.org.au. That's animalfreesci.org.au.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a food not bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to Freedom of Species on 3CR Radical Radio. Today I am here, Lottie, joined by Hayden, and we're talking about systemic and individual actions to create social change with the case study of animal justice and veganism. So another reason from what we've spoken about that it's really important to create individual actions really, really matter, as well as systemic actions that they point out in this book, Somebody Should Do Something, How Anyone Can Help Create Social Change, is that public support is needed in order for structural change to happen in the first place, but also for it to be maintained. So, you know, we can any unpopular major structural change can be repealed. So it's not really just enough necessarily for, you know, a group of passionate activists to you know, like create these structural changes if it's not going to be supported by the majority in the long term. I think a recent example of something unfortunately being repealed is Roe versus Wade in the US, abortion laws.
Although I feel like
that's more popular,
kind of weird because that is mainstream. It's popular.
Well, yes, it is. It's popular, but even that wasn't enough. So yeah. I think it's, you know, I'm just using this as an example that, you know, it's not enough to just make a structural change in the first place. There's a lot of work that needs to go into maintaining that change. Another example, this is from the book, is prohibition of alcohol in the USA from 1919 to 1933. So this was almost like a century-long build-up to prohibition taking place. There was a very long kind of advocacy working towards that in the decades and century before. But it was really, really unpopular, the prohibition of alcohol. And so that just, you know, that was repealed in 1933. And it's kind of thought of as, I don't know, not something that people can really conceptualize going back to.
And I feel like it was so unpopular, like so many people, even though there were legal structures outlawing alcohol, people were still drinking.
It wasn't really changing
And I feel like the drinking was so iconic that, like, the idea of a speakeasy, like a secret bar, we still have so many, like, in Melbourne, there's so many bars which are like, it's a little speakeasy.
Yeah, so. Yes, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that is an example that kind of highlights that if you don't have that, cultural support for something, which, personally I don't think alcohol prohibition is something that's ethically necessary, in the same way that, not killing animals or not being racist and working against climate change are ethically necessary. This is an example that just kind of highlights that that structural change in the first place isn't an alternative to the grinding and ongoing work of persuading our peers and our communities to support that change. And they say in the book, change endures when it's etched just as deeply into our hearts and minds as it is into our most basic laws. I wanted to use, coming back to veganism, the example of the plant-based treaty. So plant-based treaty is an initiative worldwide that is aiming to shift away from animal agriculture in the same ways that we're trying to, activists are trying to shift away from fossil fuel, for example. It has less of a focus on individuals needing to be vegan, immediately, and they're focusing more on these structural changes of how to work more towards a plant-based food system. Their first demand is to redirect, so eliminate the driving forces behind the problem, to promote plant-based foods and actively transition away from animal-based food systems to plant-based food systems. And what I think is kind of illustrative of what we're talking about today is that some of the kind of actions that the plant-based treaty calls for as a kind of sub-actions underneath this first demand of redirecting is that these are structural changes that are aimed to facilitate or nudge individuals to eat more vegan. So, for example, just two of these actions that they call for is to update government food and dietary guidelines to promote whole food, plant-based food, and to design public information campaigns to raise awareness about the climate and the environmental advantages and health benefits of plant-based food, nutrition, and cooking. So, if we think about these changes happening, for these changes to make any difference, people need to take up vegan eating as much as is possible. So, for you listening, if you're not a vegan, think about if, have there been kind of nudges in your life, like more vegan restaurants opening up around you, more vegan options coming into the supermarkets? And if yes, have you taken them up or have you kind of push that aside as like, well, that's not relevant to me. I'm not a vegan. My individual choices don't matter. And therefore, I'm not going to do that. I think that's something to think about because there's no point kind of arguing for these structural changes to happen if individuals aren't going to, take them on. Do you have thoughts on that?
I think something interesting is that with plant-based treaties, it's trying to shift the structural in the other direction, because I think something that people maybe aren't as aware of right now is that in addition to being the cultural and social norm, I think consuming animal products has a lot of structural impetus behind it. So I think a lot of animal agriculture industries get a lot of government subsidies.
Yep.
So that makes these much more affordable and then even lets them kind of be more ubiquitous and run advertising campaigns that normalize eating these things. So beef or dairy milk, these would be much more expensive to produce without like subsidies that they receive or tax breaks or et cetera, et cetera. And they kind of get these benefits that a lot of plant-based agriculture industries don't receive. And so kind of trying to shift the balance in the other direction structurally, I guess is one aspect of it. But then you can also with consuming animal products, that structural component is hidden, but we're also used to the cultural and normative component of it. And so I guess you know, as we've talked about, like with plant-based treaty, that's one aspect of it. And then also shifting the normative and cultural component is another big one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think if these like structural shifts happen where plant-based eating becomes, is kind of facilitated to become more and more normalized, it relies on individuals normalizing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, we all have a role to play in helping to normalize more plant-based eating.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like if we, for instance, change like the food pyramid or whatever, the food circle is it now?
Yeah, whatever it is. Food guidelines. Food guidelines.
If you change that on its own and no one else is changing how they eat, then it's one of the things everyone would just look at and kind of laugh and be like, as if, right? Like the old food pyramid when you looked at it and it was like, you should be having like 10 pieces of bread a day, and everyone is just like, that's ridiculous. But like if someone sees that and lots of people around them are eating that way, then it's easier for them to look at that and be like, oh, maybe I should be eating that way as well. So like it really does need to go hand in hand, because if no one's like walking the walk, then it doesn't matter how much you talk the talk, right? Like,
definitely. Before we go to our next song, I think maybe I'll just kind of introduce what we'll be talking about a bit more in the next segment. So when we think about, you know, if we ask people why they're not vegan or vegetarian, or maybe people who have lapsed and ask people why they didn't stay veg, or asking vegans what are the kind of challenges of it sometimes, I think social challenges are cited quite often as a reason that it can be difficult to be or stay vegan or vegetarian. I think we should all think about, well, how can this be if no one's individual choices make a difference? So what we're kind of seeing here is an example where people are actually influencing people not to be vegan, vegetarian, and that's just kind of part of the norm and culture, and that's not really questioned. It's just kind of like, oh well, socially it's hard, and so I'm not going to do it. We don't really question, well, why is it socially hard? What are these people around us doing to us? Why are they making our lives difficult when we're trying to do the right thing and trying to create social change? And you know, if we think about this on the flip side, you are part of someone else's social circle. You have a social network and a social community. And so I think it's important that people think about, what is your influence on other people? Are you encouraging people around you to be vegan or vegetarian, or are you discouraging it? And I think it's important that people kind of harness their role as an influencer, however large their circle is, to, you know, harness that role for good and to encourage people to eat more vegan, as opposed to the other way around and being someone in someone else's social circle who's contributing to, oh well, it's too hard to be vegan because it's, you know, socially it's difficult.
Yeah, and I think it's easy, like if we're talking about individual versus structural or social differences, I think it's easy, like especially in the modern day when we have access to the internet and the world's so connected, to think of the social in terms of the absolute macro and think of it in terms of the millions of people, or country level or city level or state level or however you want to, international level, and to really feel lost in that and powerless to affect it. But as you've said, I think it is important to remember that we are embedded in smaller networks. And that regardless of how small your network is, you'll have people around you who look at what you're doing and are influenced by it, and that helps them kind of how they view the world and how they view what's normal. In the same way, like when we have friends or family who do something, it can normalize it. So if your family member like takes up a hobby, or if they drink a beer every day after work.
If they smoke, this is an example they use in the book. One of the best predictors of someone becoming a smoker is how much time they spend around other smokers.
Yeah, or, you know, like all kinds of things. If they have tattoos, if they have piercings, all these things can influence what for you is normal. Like lots of friends tend to dress in similar ways because they share a similar culture. And so I think it's good to remember that, like, our social influence, we don't have to think about like the social level in this like millions of people scale. You can think of it in terms of like you have a small group around you and a small community around you who definitely are influenced by the things you do, the things you say, and the things you believe.
Mm.
And if, like, thinking of things on a broader level is overwhelming, it's okay to just be content with thinking there are people who I'm close to who will be influenced by what I do, and they have their own network that will then be influenced what they do. So, like, you can think on this smaller level, and that will still make a big social difference.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. I agree. So we'll go to a song now. This next one is The Times They're Changing by Bob Dylan. And this song basically says, the times are changing, so be part of that change.
Freedom of Species would like to thank Project Fresh Start for their financial support of this program. Project Fresh Start provides free plant-based food to the community, with a focus on providing healthy, fresh plant-based food and education around healthy eating and living in a way that sustains the individual, the community, the animals, and the planet. To find out more about our community lunches and programs, check out projectfreshstart.org.au.
From September 15th to the 22nd, The Return, a play by Alaa Al-Qaisi, will tour theatres in Brunswick, Ballarat, Keysborough and Castlemaine. The Return is the story of Marwan Abu Samra, who awaits the return of his martyred daughters Nagam and Rozan. Through poetry, music and magical realism, the play explores grief, love and what it takes to remain human in the face of unimaginable loss. For more information and tickets, go to the Free Palestine Melbourne website or look for The Return on Humanitix. Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to Freedom of Species on 3CR Radical Radio. I'm Lottie and I'm joined today by Hayden, and we are talking about the feedback loop of systemic and individual actions to create social changes. And right now we're talking about how you, yes, you, can be a vegan influencer in your circle of influence, however small or large that is.
Who, me?
Yes,
go you. Around.
So, yeah, I thought we'd kind of go through some things that you might just want to take up in your everyday life, whether, well, you know, if you're a vegan, you might kind of be doing these things anyway. And if you're not a vegan, or if you're a future vegan, aspiring vegan, anything like that, you can, you know, maybe take on these actions to try to normalize and support veganism in your social sphere. And yeah, I think if you're not a vegan or vegetarian, you could do this both around other vegans and vegetarians to kind of support them in their endeavors, and also make sure you're doing it around non-vegans and non-vegetarians, to normalize, more, you know, vegan eating, plant-based eating. And I guess, you know, an advantage you might have if you're not a vegan is you might be perceived less negatively and less preachy than vegans doing this. So if you happen to not be a vegan, then at least, yeah, I think it's positive if you try and harness that kind of advantage that you have there. So, yeah, should I go through some ideas and you jump in?
Yeah.
You jump in if you've got some ideas too. So yeah, I think it's important that everyone has conversations showing your support and interest in veganism, animal rights and vegan food systems, the same way that, you know, every so often we talk about, you know, that climate change is happening and it's a bad thing and we believe in it and we believe in, we advocate for changes to mitigate climate change. You know, if the topics come up, we will generally show our support that we're not racist and we're not homophobic and things like that. Just make it normal when the topic comes up, that to kind of show that you're interested in this as a topic, you love animals and you think they deserve rights and justice, and just to kind of normalize that as an idea.
And I think somewhat related, I know there are lots of people who don't feel confident talking about vegan issues, which I think is fair compared to more mainstream things like climate change or potentially even like racism. People sometimes have an experience of people responding negatively, which discourages them from speaking, or they just don't feel confident. Something I saw someone on Reddit suggest, which has been successful for them, is they give gifts to people that they're close to of books about veganism that they like, and they just give the gift without an expectation that the person will read it. But they found that sometimes people read it and then they'll have lots of questions and they'll want to talk about it. That's so I think nice. That yeah. can be a nice way if you're someone who doesn't feel as comfortable having those conversations and bringing it up when it arises in conversation. That's could be an alternative for you if you have books that you've found helpful or influential, just giving them as kind of no expectation gifts to people with the hope that maybe they'll read it, but not being too upset if they don't.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, this doesn't need to just be initiating conversations about animal justice. It could also, you know, if you don't kind of have the confidence for that, but just when the topic comes up, you know, if there's vegan food around and you say, oh, yum, that's, you know, that's nice, or someone says something in support of animals and you just show that you agree, I think that's really important, just to have those kind of, you know, little shows of support as well as big ones, of course. When it comes to eating habits, I think that there are ways that people could change their eating habits, even just in small ways, that will have some kind of influence on the people around them. So, you know, I think you could consider seeking out and eating at all vegan restaurants just as a habit, not only when you've got a vegan in the group, but just because there are some great restaurants out there and they're worth supporting and they have great food. You could check out Happy Cow, the app, to seek out vegan restaurants. You can also just use a maps app and search vegan, and or a search engine and search vegan restaurants, and you'll find a lot, especially if you live in a city like Melbourne where we live.
And I think as a vegan, like, I personally, if I'm going out with friends or whatever, I like to suggest, especially when I'm going out with non-vegan friends, I like to suggest going to a vegan restaurant because it forces the people I'm going with to eat vegan. But also I think it's nice because then by default, like, I think a lot of times if you're going out to eat with friends, it can be nice to share. And if you go to a vegan place, then, you know, regardless, you're going to be able to share with people, and there's no awkwardness or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so it just facilitates that social aspect of it, and it can open their eyes to restaurants that they otherwise wouldn't get to go to. And I don't think I've ever taken someone to a vegan restaurant and had them not enjoy it.
Yep. Yep. And I guess what we're saying is, as non-vegans, you can still do that. You don't need to wait for a vegan to suggest going to a vegan restaurant. You can just say, oh, I really love this place, Kevabs on Sydney Road.
shout out to the best restaurant of them all.
Let's go there. If you're not at a fully vegan place, you could just maybe stop the filter that you have in your brain of filtering out the vegan option because you're not a vegan, and as a habit, look for the vegan option.
I would say, like, look at it first, and if it looks good, order it. And then if it doesn't look good, maybe then you can check the rest of the menu if you're not a vegan.
Yeah, but try and get into the habit of just choosing the vegan option if you like the look of it, and if it, you know, if it suits you. And yeah, encourage sharing vegan dishes. So yeah, if it's not a fully vegan place, but you like the look of some vegan dishes, encourage the people around you to get a few things to share that are also vegan, and that will encourage them to try out vegan food and maybe also stop filtering out the vegan options. I think anyone can learn some vegan baking or cooking recipes and feed people yummy vegan food if you have people around for dinner, or if you're going to a picnic or a potluck. Try to by default cook or share vegan food, just so people are exposed to vegan food and realize that a lot of the time it's delicious and can be done really well, and sometimes you can't even tell the difference, especially if it's baking.
And if you're someone who isn't vegan, or, you know, you're aspiring vegan, but you don't, or you struggle a lot with cooking vegan yourself, just putting in that little bit of effort, like, you can find that you can match most of the flavors and just like see which ingredients are easier to sub for vegan ones. Like, because a lot of times, like, it's very easy to sub one for one for a vegan alternative and maintain taste. So it's just really easy for you to do.
Yeah, there's lots of recipes out there on the internet. In a few months, I'm going to be doing a bit of a how-to be a vegan in a kind of sustainable way for yourself, for different people. So maybe look out for that episode where I'll be sharing a lot of websites that have tips and recipes. Maybe if you're in a social situation, like people are organizing a dinner party, you could just make the suggestion, how about we do all vegan? That makes it easier for everyone to make sure it's inclusive for everyone. I can share some recipe ideas, just facilitate other people around you. If they kind of seem to think that it's a barrier to be able to cook or bake vegan food, put yourself out there as a bit of a vegan expert, and just kind of show that there's not this like huge barrier to entry. It's pretty normal. A lot of food that we eat is by default vegan if we eat vegetables. I guess I thought of some example, maybe like go-to lines that you might have in your pocket if you feel like it kind of helps you with your confidence, to kind of justify to people why you might be eating vegan some of the time, even if you're not strictly vegan all the time. So you might just say something like, oh, I've reached my animal product quota for the week, I'm going to have the vegan option. Or just even simply, oh, I feel like the vegan option today. Or, oh, I don't really feel like beef or cheese or chicken or whatever today. Or, oh, the seitan looks good. So, you know, just maybe depending on who you're with and what you think they might be a bit more receptive to, you can focus on just what looks good or what doesn't look as good. Or you can be kind of more specific about, yeah, I'm trying to eat a bit more vegan, so I'm going to eat the vegan option. Do you have kind of more thoughts about that?
No, I don't think so. Not in terms of how to speak to people about making those choices. I think that, you know, obviously tailoring it to the situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we talked about, you can influence people. So where it's especially a non-judgmental space, I think being open and honest to, like, I'm trying to be more vegan, I think it's better for animals and better for the environment maybe, or, like, the reasons that you have for wanting to be vegan, sharing those with others and having good faith that they'll be receptive to them and will respond well. And I think giving others the benefit of the doubt in that way as well is important.
Yeah, exactly. It seems to me sometimes that people, if they have reasons that they can't be 100% perfectly vegan, they kind of just psychologically shut it out as something relevant to them. But then on the other hand, we also have a lot of rhetoric about like, oh, well, it's better if everyone ate less meat rather than 5% of people being vegan. And I think us as vegans might get a bit frustrated that, like, well, okay, if you're going to argue for that, at least do that. So I think there's a bit of barrier to break down about people just realizing that, like, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to be vegan tomorrow, but this is something I care about, and so I'm going to make some small changes in my life to just, you know, eat more vegan every so often. So yeah, I'm encouraging you as the listener to do that, and I'm encouraging you to encourage people around you in ways that you can to kind of make that shift.
And I don't know if you have it on your list, I just thinking of food as well. I know a lot of people go out sometimes every day or at least once a week to go get a coffee from a coffee shop or a coffee alternative. And I think just experimenting with non-dairy milks is something you should do. I think they're so ubiquitous now, a lot of places don't even upcharge you for a non-dairy milk now, and just finding one that you like. And I think as well, like, sometimes you might think, oh, this doesn't taste how I'm used to it tasting, but a lot of these things as well can be just like exactly like what you're used to. So if you just do it for a few weeks, suddenly that will be the normal for you, and you might then try dairy again and be like, oh, this doesn't taste very good.
Yeah.
And like a hot tip is that I know baristas' preference for putting with drinks is oat, because that's the one that froths and just generally has the same characteristics or the most similar characteristics to dairy milk. But I'll also shout out soy because I feel like I don't drink coffee. I only drink tea and tea adjacent things. And even when I was vegetarian and I had dairy milk, I was mind blown by how much better tea tastes with soy milk than it does with dairy milk.
Yep.
It must be something about the fact it comes from China and it knows it's supposed to be paired with soy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, even just that being a change in your daily habits, I think is a positive individual change that you can make that might influence people around you.
And then I think it's helpful. It facilitates things for vegans as well, because the more people who are ordering non-dairy milks at coffee shops, the more ubiquitous it is and the more cafes will stop upcharging for it as well.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, we're going to wrap up now. Thanks for joining me, Hayden. The last song that we're going to play is From Little Things, Big Things Grow. This is written by Kev Carmody and Paul Kelly, and this version is performed by Dan Sultan, who is actually a Gurundjeri and Aranda man and a descendant of Vincent Lingari, who this song is about, which I think is really special, as well as John Butler and Missy Higgins. So yeah, stay tuned for Rotations to hear some more music. Thanks for joining us today. And
I'm also going to say hell yeah to Missy Higgins, who's an animal rights advocate and a vegetarian.
Oh, great. I didn't know that. All right. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.